I don't know if it was the first one, but kind of the most popular early browser was Mosaic. And you could get Mosaic and put it on your computer, assuming that you had, you know, a decent screen. You know, you could see pretty good visual imagery. It was kind of limited.
Yeah, those were the early days. You know, just waiting for stuff to display was, you could go and get a beer, you know, make a sandwich, come back, and it's still trying to render.
Yeah.
You know, the product that really changed my life, remember Real Audio from Real Networks?
Mm-hmm.
That was when I first was able to actually do radio on the internet in a really clunky sort of way. This time on the Plutopia podcast, we take another nostalgic trip into the early days of computing and online communication. We discuss our first computers and their impact on our lives, our early online experiences, programs and services that changed the way we work and play, and much more.
Hey, welcome everybody to another episode of the Plutopia podcast. And today you get Scoop Sweeney and John Lebkoski, Scoop and I, as your only rambling fools. We're going to talk about our history with computers and the internet, our personal history, or our secret history, I guess you could say. And I suppose to start things off, I would just ask you, Scoop, what was your first computer?
Well, my first computer was a tiny little thing from Radio Shack, the Tandy Corporation's Radio Shack, back when it was actually a going enterprise and selling all sorts of electronics. And they had this thing, the MC-10, the micro color computer, had a whole 8K of memory, John, random access memory, 8K, that's just ridiculous. I got an expansion add-on that gave me a whole 16K, so I was just like twice as cool. And the data was all stored on cassette tape. It just, the machine came with a little cassette recorder that you plugged in the back, and you saved it at the end of your session, or you know, save your program when you were done and compiling it. And language was basic. It was very basic, but it taught me good programming skills. I learned about Boolean logic, the if-then-else way of having your data flow through a program, or have your program flow through your data, whatever you're doing. And it was just a lot of fun. It was a tiny little thing. I actually ended up using it when I was at that time I was managing a band in the Bay Area called Vital Signs, and we did a lot of touring around California and the West Coast. And I put this little thing into my Anvil briefcase, which is a nice bulletproof briefcase, had it all, you know, in there snugly with foam rubber, and I could keep track of all of our expenses and our schedules, because it had a calc program, had a word processor, had a modem, and so I could actually send a fax from this thing if I went on to one of the online services like CompuServe, who I believe it was either CompuServe or Genie that had a fax outlet where you could send them data and it would go out to a fax number. And so it proved to be a useful tool when I was managing the band. And that was quite a lot of fun, just being able to, you know, put stuff into a computer and have it save it, and you bring it back up and run it, and it actually ran. So I felt like a computer god.
Did you use a spreadsheet?
Calc was kind of, it was a spreadsheet program. It was very basic. It wasn't anything super like, Microsoft, Excel or Lotus 1-2-3, which I got into later on. But it was basic, and for doing financial calculations and for storing data, I kept our books for the band because we spent a lot of money on the road, made a lot of money, and so I was able to keep the bank balanced. And it was a great tool, and I encountered a lot of other bands who were just like, what the hell are you doing? And I told them, they were like, damn, I've got to get one of those things. So how about you?
So you said calc. Was it calc or VisiCalc? Was VisiCalc something that came later?
This was, you know, a proprietary program that Radio Shack had. They just called it calc. And I'm sure they licensed it from someone, but you know, it wasn't VisiCalc. It was just very basic, you know, spreadsheet program.
Yeah, because I think VisiCalc was developed by Bob Frankston, I think, at some point, and later was like morphed into Lotus 1-2-3, if I remember my history correctly.
Yeah, now Lotus.
But spreadsheets were kind of like the thing that attracted a lot of people back then. Mm-hmm. And the first time I saw a computer, my brother had bought one of the Tandy computers. It might have been one of those TRS-80s. I'm pretty sure it was. Mm-hmm. And he was showing it to me and showing me how he could do a spreadsheet and so forth. And I just really wasn't moved by it. Mm-hmm. I didn't get excited about the idea of owning a computer until I found out that computers could connect with other computers. Mm-hmm. And that you could have conversations and communication online, and even, you know, join groups of people that could form into communities and that sort of thing. And that's what got me excited about it. And the way that I found out about that was through Coevolution Quarterly. And I should say I was a pretty devoted follower of the Whole Earth catalog and all of the related publications and kind of the tribe of people that were involved with that. So I was constantly, I had my nose in that thing all the time. And one thing I started seeing with my nose in the Coevolution Quarterly was in the part at the back that would be talking about how they were starting a bulletin board system. They were going to create BBS. They were going to create a thing called the WELL, or Whole Earth Electronic Link. An idea that Stuart Brand had along with Larry Brilliant and Point Foundation and some company that Larry Brilliant was involved with kind of partnered on this thing. So they actually started it as a business. In other words, people had to pay to be on the WELL, which was different from some of the smaller BBSs. You know, there were BBSs all over the place where somebody would just kind of set one up and open it up and invite people to join them, and anybody could dial in. But I wanted to be on the WELL, and I knew I would have to figure out a way to make a long distance call to get there, but I wasn't going to get there unless I bought a computer. So we got a bank loan, and I looked around, maybe asked some people or whatever, to find out what computer would you recommend, you know? Wait, I'm trying to find this here. The computer that came pretty highly recommended at the time was a computer called the PCs Limited. It was like an IBM clone. I mean, the company was PCs Limited. Let's see if I can blow this thing up so you can see. It just says PCs Limited Turbo PC. It was an 8088 processor, and kind of where these PCs Limited computers came from, a guy named Michael Dell, I'm sure that's a familiar name to a lot of people, as a student at the University of Texas, realized that he could take the components, like he could acquire computer components and assemble them and build a computer. And he started doing that and selling them to people that he just kind of knew around UT. And it worked out so well that he decided to start this company, PCs Limited. I think it was actually a DBA for Dell Computers. But Dell Computers originally launched as PCs Limited. And they were also sort of an on-demand inventory thing. They didn't have a computer there for you. If you went into their shop, you went to a desk and you kind of told them what you wanted. They kind of showed you what the options were. And you picked out the pieces. And then you came back on the date they told you to and picked up a lot of boxes of stuff. You had a box with the actual computer in it, you know, built into the computer chassis. And you got the box with the monitor, which was a monochrome monitor, no color at that time. And in fact, all you had was text in one color. And the options for colors were either green or amber. So I got an amber monitor. And when I ordered the computer, I also ordered it with a 300 baud modem built into it because I already knew what I wanted to do with it. It was kind of a hard sell. My wife wasn't sure that we should buy, like spend $3,000 on a computer. You know, we had to get a bank loan to buy the thing. But she was a realtor, and I reminded her that she could dial into her multiple listing service with this computer. So there was a utility for her, and it made it a pretty good business decision to buy the thing. Oh, and I got a dot matrix printer with it too, which was a printer that printed pretty plain. You know, I mean, I think you didn't have any options really or font or anything like that, but you could just print stuff out and it would come scrolling out. So I took all this stuff home and took things out of boxes, and I had this huge pile of manuals that were practically unreadable. You know, they had all been written by engineers, really. They weren't that easy to decipher, and you had to get yourself into the right mindset to get through those things. And I just got put everything together, and I was ready to dial into the well. But this was in the era where if you wanted to call far away, you had to pay a long distance cost. And, you know, it would have been something like $25 an hour in long distance fees. Plus, I think the well was $2 an hour, as I recall. So they were going to charge me something. And the phone company was going to charge me something. And it was going to really pile up. So I didn't immediately call the well. I think I did call it early on and sign up for it and maybe dropped off and then came back later. But since it seemed a little impractical to make these long distance calls to log into the well, at least at first, I started calling local BBSs, bulletin board systems. I guess the first one that I called and one that I started to frequent was called SMOF, S-M-O-F, BBS. SMOF stood for Secret Masters of Fandom. And this bulletin board was operated by a guy named Earl Cooley, who called himself Shiva. That was his handle. And there was another guy on there who called himself Jules Verne, and that turned out to be Bruce Sterling. And Johnny Mnemonic turned out to be Mike Godwin. And I have a whole story I could tell about how meeting those people and joining the well got me involved in a big way in the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And we might get to that, I don't know. But suffice to say, I started calling the local bulletin boards and eventually joined the well and started making these long distance calls and discovered a program that would allow me to download new stuff that people had added. The way the well was set up, it was called a conferencing system. And you had these major subject areas that you had conferences for those. And then discussions within those conferences were just called topics. So you'd join the well. And then you'd go into a conference and you would start reading topics within that conference. And, you know, you would read what people had posted since you were last there, and then you would post something yourself, or you might not post, you might just lurk, you might just be there reading. So that was actually my first experience with interacting with people online. And it was a little stiff at first because of the fact that I had to be in and out pretty quickly. You know, like I say, I could download the new posts and then I could write responses and upload those, but that made it even more asynchronous. But eventually I found a Sprint thing called, like Sprint had a thing called PC Pursuit, which used their, you could pay a flat rate and use their trunk lines to dial into bulletin boards that were remote. So you'd pay $30 a month. And for $30 a month, I could have kind of unlimited dialing into the well. And I did that for a long time. It wasn't a very high quality connection. Later, I discovered something called CompuServe Packet Networks, or CPN, which was basically using CompuServe's system for connecting to CompuServe. They would also let people sign up and use it to dial into other systems. And that was something like $2 an hour. So with that, and with the well being $2 an hour, it became more like $4 an hour. It was kind of manageable at that point.
Yeah, CompuServe was my first experience with an actual online service other than the local bulletin board services. I was fortunate to be in the Bay Area, and there were a lot of really cool BBSs there. So you didn't have to dial long distance, because any kind of long distance call in those days, you had to bring a big bag of quarters and hope that you didn't run the bill up too much. But one thing that I discovered, and it actually came with the Radio Shack computer. I got a much better one pretty quickly. I got a Tandy 2000, which was it's right here, actually. And let me show you the Tandy 2000.
That's, oh, nice.
Yeah, and that was nice. It was 80187 that it ran on. It was a weird divergence from the 80188, and it was advertised as running this, you know, all the IBM compatible programs, but it really wasn't, because it was just a different chip that it ran on. And but it was nice and fast. It had 128K of memory. It had two floppy drives, and
Matt ought to explain what a floppy drive is.
Yes, a floppy drive, in being a computer disk that you, they were 5 1/4 inch. The ones that I used, they got smaller as technology progressed. But this one had 5 1/4 inch floppy disk that you shoved into one of the drives. Yeah, one of the drives had to have the MS-DOS operating system on it, because it didn't come residing in the computer like it does, you know, in a modern computer. But this actually had MS-DOS on a floppy disk that you put in, and when you turned on the machine, it booted up from that drive and ran the MS-DOS operating system. And then if you were going to load a program or save a program, you used the other floppy drive and saved or loaded, you know, from another 5 1/4 inch floppy disk. Yeah, but it was, you know, at the time, I was just thrilled. It's like, this is great. This is high tech. This is what, until I saw some of the, you know, newer stuff that was coming out. But, you know, I enjoyed the experience with Tandy, and I actually picked up their one of the first, not really laptop, but similar to a laptop, the Tandy 102, and then later the Tandy 200, which were transportable. They were nice little battery operated. You know, you could also have an AC adapter, but you could run it off of a battery anywhere. It had a nice little screen on it, and it had a nice modem. And it also had, you know, programs built in like calc and word processing and a telecom program to where you could go online with it. And that proved to be really helpful because it came with a program or a subscription to the Dow Jones News Service, which Dow Jones was promoting. And it actually, you know, really proved useful when I was managing Vital Signs. We did a song for the movie Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, and that was supposed to come out in 1988. So in late 1987, we recorded a song for the soundtrack, and then nothing happened. We were waiting for it was supposed to be released in 1988. Turned out that Dino De Laurentiis, the great Italian producer, was the production company behind Bill and Ted's, and they got into serious debt and went bankrupt. So we were in, you know, limbo there, and I use the Dow Jones service to just put in keywords about the movie, and it would bring up whatever the latest developments were, because you couldn't find that in anything. Even the music trades and movie trades didn't really track, you know, non-existent movies. But all of a sudden, I started seeing that they were actually working on the movie again. And they had a bunch of the people who used to work for De Laurentiis that went in and combined with Orion to bring the movie out. And it came out finally in 1989. But I was able to, you know, keep the band together. You know, it's coming, just thanks to, you know, Dow Jones of all things. But it was a great little news service. So I would track various subjects. And it didn't have to be investment related or stocks and bonds. They had a link to a lot of different, you know, news services like Reuters and Agence France-Presse. And so they just kind of sucked it into their database. And if you looked for it, you could find it on there. So I used that for quite a while before I came up with things like search engines, like AltaVista. Was the first really good search engine. Did you
remember it well?
Oh, yeah. That was great. When search engines became a thing, a good thing, it really changed the whole game, because you were able to look for stuff that you didn't know where it was or if it was. You could go and search, and it would find it.
Yeah, I mean, there was no way to find things. Well, no great way to find things. Especially on the web. So the web appeared in the early 90s. And initially, we were accessing it with a program called Lynx, which gave you text, no visuals or anything like that. It was like a Unix program called Lynx. And I recall, you know, it was like the trick was knowing how to find a website that had something that you wanted to see. There had been some search functionalities built for the internet when it was mostly a matter of like needing to find files. The way that you could access things on the internet before the web was through something like FTP, where you would transfer files, but you had to know where the files were.
You got to know the exact name too. Exact name, you couldn't get it.
Well, there were search engines like Archie and Veronica. I'm trying to find something about. Okay, here, Veronica. Veronica was a search system for Gopher. So I should mention Gopher. I was actually curator of a Gopher. At one time, Gopher was sort of like a bridge between FTP and the web. Gopher was you had a visual menu interface that would allow you to access text files just by entering on a thing on the screen. In other words, you would select something and it would feed you the text on your screen. So you could it was like reading online, which people do all the time on the web now, but it was a new thing there. Veronica was kind of an essential way to find the gophers that had information that you wanted. We made one for the well, and the one that we had on the well, the gopher we had there, was one of the first gophers that wasn't just mostly technical stuff. You know, we were putting cultural stuff on there. I talked to the people at Mondo 2000, which was a popular magazine at the time, and got them to agree to put some of their text files on there, for instance. Anyway, when the web came, that's when it made sense to figure out a way to search the web. And Alta Vista was, at the time it launched, the best of those search engines.
If you didn't pay attention to the way to phrase your search, you know, you'd miss out on a lot of things. It took me a while to catch on to how to do the search query, which was the most important thing. Because if you just said, you know, show me George Bush, you know, or just typed in George Bush, it'd bring up some. But you wanted something that said, you know, I want to see George Bush and the Russians. You had to say that in a way that the search engine would go, okay, let's find all that stuff that contains that text.
So you might have search operators or whatever that would help you do that.
But that was just such a great tool, and it saved me so many times. And then, you know, of course, other things came out like Yahoo and then eventually Google. And so suddenly you could really find stuff that was interesting.
Yeah, we had our little company called Fringeware at the time, and I remember communicating with the two guys who were founders of Yahoo about our entry on there. It was like a very small thing at the time, and they were the contact points. You know, it had not really built into a company yet. But there was this interesting sort of evolution there from text-based to visual with images.
Mm-hmm.
And that started on with the web, the development of the web, and then the development of something called a browser. I don't know if it was the first one, but kind of the most popular early browser was Mosaic. And you could get Mosaic and put it on your computer, assuming that you had, you know, a decent screen. You know, you could see pretty good visual imagery. It was kind of limited. And I remember one of the first websites that was really super visual was one for a band called Megadeth.
Oh yeah,
and when I heard about the Megadeth site and decided to look at it, it took over an hour for their homepage to load because of all the images they had on it.
Yeah, those were the early days. You know, just waiting for stuff to display was, you could go and get a beer, you know, make a sandwich, come back, and it's still trying to render.
Yeah.
You know, the product that really changed my life, remember Real Audio? From Real Networks.
Mm-hmm.
That was when I first was able to actually do radio on the internet in a really clunky sort of way. You had to still create a file that people had to come and click on and play. But it was a real game changer because you could take your digitized audio and use the Real Audio application and it could be posted on the internet, and people could hear your whatever it was that you recorded, and that was just a revelation to me when I was able to do that. It's like, okay, now this has possibilities. Of course, it was pretty basic.
I think this is where I first started to cultivate patience, because everything was so slow, and it wasn't just that connecting was slow. I mean, we'd get faster and faster modem. I eventually got a 1200 baud modem, and then what, 5400 or something like, or 9600?
Yeah, 9600 was the real game changer.
Yeah, we kept escalating the speeds on that. But also, people may not remember this because we almost all get solid state drives in our computers now that are really fast to retrieve data. But mechanical hard drives were very slow to retrieve data. Everything just went kind of slow, you know. And you eventually got past frustration to, as I said, patience. You know, you learn to wait for things.
You know, the other real game changer for me was when it became there became a lot of internet service providers that didn't require you to sign up for something like AOL or CompuServe, who would try to pretend they were the internet. But yeah, I got my first one that was out of Walnut Creek, and it was called CCNet. And they were just great. They were some very great geeky folks who were working in the data center ghetto of Walnut Creek, and really nice. They were reliable. They were speedy, way more speedy than what I was getting. Trying to get stuff by going through some of the proprietary things like CompuServe or Genie. And it just opened up the world where you could go anywhere if you knew where you were going. There were no roadmaps to follow except Yahoo maybe. But that was great when you had that proliferation of internet service providers, which didn't last too long. They ended up being sucked up by the big companies. But it was nice to be with one of the independent ones. You could do a lot more.
Yeah, you know, some of that evolution was happening here in Austin. And it's kind of interesting story. When I first got access to the internet, it was because I had met a guy named John Quarterman, who was an internet consultant. And we were part of this creation of a chapter for the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Austin, they were going to do chapters, and Austin was going to have that alpha chapter of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. So we founded a thing called EFF Austin. And it turned out they didn't do chapters. So we became the only sort of spinoff of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And John, as I say, was an internet consultant and was very skilled with Unix and with internet systems and that sort of thing. And he took me under his wing, so to speak, and started teaching me all of these things. He was teaching me some Unix, which I could also use on the well. The well was on a Unix system. And he gave me access to Telnet on their systems so that I could dial into TIC.com, Texas Internet Consulting, and connect from there to the well. So for the first time, I had a free way to access the well. And one of the things he said to me early on was, the well is not the internet. You've got to remember that. The well is not the internet. And really, the point was that no destination on the internet is the internet. The internet is this really big thing. John wrote a book called The Matrix, which was about the internet and all systems that connect through the internet. And it was, the internet grew fast and it was massive. There was also a thing called FidoNet that our friend Tom Jennings founded back in the day that became sort of like a first internet. You know, it was connecting BBSs basically. There were FidoNet BBSs that were networked. But what I was going to get to is that in Austin at the time, there was a pretty active community of people who were interested in the internet and using it, and using it not, I mean, there were not technology people using the internet to talk about technology or do technology, but they were, you know, writers, artists, hackers, and poets, as somebody once said. All kinds of people who were getting online and becoming early adopters. And there was a group of guys here in Austin who started, it was like Bob Gustwick Associates, I think it was called BGA. They started an internet service provider company, ISP, called Realtime. And as far as I know, I think that may have been the first, certainly one of the first providers of internet services of that kind. And or a commercial like ISP. So I got on Realtime, and when we started Fringeware, we were doing it through Realtime. And at some point, Steve Jackson, there's a whole story about how Steve Jackson Games was raided by the Secret Service, and he sued the Secret Service, et cetera, et cetera. I won't get into that whole story now. That's one we should talk about sometime. But part of that was EFF got involved with Steve and helped Steve with his case against the Secret Service. And Steve became an early poster boy for cyber liberties and for EFF. And it was through that we ended up starting EFF Austin. And Steve had a lot of computers. And we started, there was a thing called RoboFest. There was something here called the Robot Group, and they're still around in Austin. It's guys who like to build robots, right? They would do a thing called RoboFest every year, which was kind of like a technology festival thing that they would put on. And it was getting bigger and bigger. And I connected with those guys and then brought Fringeware and EFF Austin into the mix, so that one year we were doing RoboFest with Fringeware and EFF Austin, both really involved with them and having our roles in kind of helping to put the thing on. And as RoboFest was approaching, a guy named Doug Barnes, who's now a tech attorney in like New York area, Doug Barnes was at the time a systems administrator. And he said, you know, what we really ought to do is set up a local area network or a LAN at RoboFest so that people can have that experience, can see what that's like. And one thing we could add to that is a MOO, multi-user object oriented platform, which is sort of like a text-based virtual reality. You go in there and there's objects and locations that are described as text. And, you know, people were hanging out in MOOs. It was a step in the direction of virtual reality, but it was all described in text. And that was called Metaverse after the snow crash Metaverse. Doug knew Neil Stephenson and used that name with Neil Stephenson's permission. And Steve wanted to make the Metaverse a product. So in order to make it a product, he needed a way for people to reach it. Basically, it led to the idea that we will build an ISP called Illuminati Online, IO.com. We'll provide regular ISP services, but we'll also have this MOO, Metaverse MOO, as part of the product. And that turned out to be a very interesting thing. They set up IO.com And it became a very successful ISP. The Metaverse move was less successful. I think it eventually went away, but io.com was kind of a big deal. And there were people all over the country getting io.com email addresses. It was kind of considered a sexy email address at the time. So that became another big sort of internet service provider, commercial internet service provider, and another step in the direction of creating ISPs. Eventually, there were ISPs all over the country. And of course, now today, people get their internet service through something like Spectrum, which you and I both know and love.
Oh, yes. We call them, in our household, we call it speculum cable because they are somewhat invasive and intrusive and quirky. And as you well know from a recent experience.
Yeah, we had some downtime yesterday. Well, it's been pretty good for me. I don't know what else I would do to get fast connectivity out here.
Yeah, out here in the sticks, it's somewhat more spotty. Yeah, anytime there's a electrical storm, you can count on them being blasted off. In fact, we had a big rainstorm and thunderstorm come through a couple of weeks ago, and it knocked out power for a brief time. And apparently, there was a power surge, and it knocked out my power line adapters that I use for funneling my network to the other side of the house, and it fried those, and I think it fried my monitor on the wall behind me there, and I've yet to go in and look at it because it's just too depressing to think about yet another surge victim. But that's just one of those things when you're out in the country. But the whole thing about the internet becoming popular, what really I felt spurred it onto what it is now is when people other than the techie geeks were finding things they could do with it. And as that spread, you got a lot of people. I ran into people in the Bay Area who had heard about the internet, but they just didn't think it would. They said, I'm not a programmer. I'm not a geek. I don't know what I can do. And I told a few people, you could do this and this and this. And they go, oh, really? And then immediately they go out and get on the internet. And that kind of thing happened all over, where it didn't matter what your passion was, you could find a lot of folks out there who had the same passion and were forming affinity groups, either on an online service or on their own website. You could find ways to get in touch with people that were into almost anything. My wife, she loved to sew, and she did seamstress and the embroidery work, and she found people on the internet who had things that they would share with her, so she got, craft tips. And you find a lot of that stuff, and that's when the internet became more than just a geeky, secret playground. It became a big thing.
Well, I had a rap about that when we were doing Fringeware. I would say in every little town in the USA, there's people who are just kind of like fringe thinkers that think differently, and they can't find in their little town other people who think the way they do. But on the internet, they can find those people. And, Fringeware was kind of about bringing those people together. And unfortunately, that also is the thing that the impetus for something like QAnon to form. People who are thinking about things that are a little bit strange and finding each other inside of conspiracy theories.
Yeah, the whole thing of the internet really helped me because it helped me get into a whole new career, because I got, early on, as soon as the web came along, I got into, HTML programming, and I was able to convince the Kaiser Permanente medical care program where I worked to let me convert one of their they're handbooks, really. You know, there are different kinds of coverage that they had, and the medical group had it in print. So if you wanted to find out what somebody's coverage was, you had to rifle through all these pages. And I went in and coded the same thing as HTML, where all you had to do was have a browser, and you clicked on the table of contents, and it took you right to the place. And it was, you know, 100 times faster than going through this big manual. And they hated it because they just couldn't get away from that big manual of paper. But the guys in the IT group said, hey, we could use that kind of thing. Come over and work with us. So I got to go over and double my pay and have a lot of fun.
Yeah, I am. As an internet early adopter, somebody who kind of started to understand the internet pretty well and who almost started an e-commerce company. I should say Fringeware was supposed to do e-commerce, but the banks wouldn't let us accept credit cards because this was before SSL existed, before secure encryption was commonly used. We knew that we could encrypt the credit card numbers and so forth, but it wasn't widely understood, so it wasn't something we could get started with. But I'd done all that stuff, and Whole Foods Market decided they wanted to build e-commerce, a nice big e-commerce site, and they hired me to be their internet guy. I actually had cards that said internet guy on them. They had a guy in there called the food guy, so I just became the internet guy. And a lot of what I did early on with them was kind of sell the company, like promote the internet to people within the company. And one thing that I focused on was the fact that Whole Foods had depended on community for its actual survival. I mean, the first store was almost wiped out by a flood, and the community of people who shopped at that store and who frequented that store showed up to help kind of bring it back and build it back. And the whole history of Whole Foods was kind of like having a very strong presence within whatever community it was part of. So we sold that. And when we built the e-commerce site, I became community director, and we had an online community. We had forums that were using the same software that The Well started using for its web interface. And we also had online chats and that sort of thing. We had a pretty good time with that, for sure.
Yeah, but one of my first problems with using credit cards online was I built a website for my friend Rebecca Desmond's county fair in far northern California. She's now the executive director of the California Fairs Association, so she's the boss over all the county fairs. But that was her first one, and she wanted a website, so I went and built her a very rudimentary website. And I also did the concert production for her fair, so it was in my best interest to make it successful. And they wanted to sell the concert tickets online, and they couldn't get any luck with any of the local banks to work out some sort of deal. So I did a little kind of do-it-yourself, not really encryption, just misdirection. So it had if you wanted to buy a concert ticket, you clicked on a button, and it presented you with a page that showed you filled in your name and your credit card number and all the information they needed and how many tickets. And then when you were completed with that, you hit send. And what it did is it sent an email out with a weird, non-financial subject line. It was something like, livestock report, and it went out not to their email system, but to one of mine, because I had all these dummy email addresses. So it bounced off of my domain, and then back to them in a form that was just the basics of the, you know, the name and the credit card numbers, and they were all scrambled to where they weren't in the order you would expect. But the people in the office, I gave them a decoder that said, okay, this number is that number, and that number is it was very Mickey Mouse. But it worked. We never had any problems with it. And when I finally, you know, moved out here, they got someone else to do it, and they couldn't figure out how the hell it worked.
Homebrew encryption.
Yeah, it's just misdirection. That tends to work.
Well, when we first launched the site at WholeFoods.com, I immediately started getting contacts from people I knew were like internet people, you know, saying, "Hey, you're not encrypting the sales transactions." And sure enough, the guys who built the site didn't set that up. I may not even realize they needed to. Fixed it really quick, but I was thinking, wow, that could be bad. We had a situation at one point where I remember what it was. So people would make a purchase, and when they did submit, it would just kind of lag there for a while, and they'd eventually hit submit again. And they keep hitting submit until it finally went through. Every time they hit submit, it debited their bank account. So eventually their bank accounts were empty.
That's a lot of fun there. Now that's good customer service.
So I think we had to write code to actually like back those things back out and get people their money back.
Yeah, I created a few web pages that not a financial disaster like that, but you know, I learned as a result of this disaster to not put something live unless you really tested it. Because if you clicked on this one area, it would get into this loop, and it would just go, and everything would go crazy, and people would just go, no, I can't deal with that. And I wondered why people were just dropping off. It's like, oh, that's not nice at all. So, I became a real fan of quality assurance testing. It makes a lot of difference if you do extensive testing of anything that you put online, because you never know what's going to happen to your nice code that you put out there.
Yeah,
my very first job with the Kaiser Permanente Information Technology was QA testing, and we'd just gotten this new package for billing and claims, and we were supposed to test it out. And immediately I went in and tried to assign a task to myself, and I clicked it, and it just took the system down because it got into a loop because it was trying to do this thing over and over. It tried to complete a task that could not be completed because I made it do something you weren't supposed to do. So that was our first fix. We had to go and prevent anyone from doing that, assigning a task to themselves.
And yeah, in all my history with web development and being around web stuff, testing has always been like a huge part of everything that we've done.
It's expensive.
All the way back to,
It's expensive. Because
it can be. I mean, it kind of depends on how you approach it, how expensive it really gets. I've been in situations where one of the real bugaboos in web development is that somebody asks you to build something and they tell you what they want you to build, and you build it. And you build it according to what they told you. And then you deliver it and they say, well, that's not what I wanted. Mm-hmm. And it happens all the time. I would almost say more often than not. Even if you have pretty good communications, what happens is that once they see what it is, their wheels start turning and they start thinking of like,
I should have asked
it
for this,
different, or other things they might want to do. And they always want you to make all of their changes without charging them any extra money. And we battled with that all the years I was in web development. That was something that we had to battle with over and over again. As people say, "What? Why are you charging me so much money?" You know, it's like, you shouldn't be charging me for this. You know, it's like you told me it was going to be this, and now it's way up here to this. And it's like, well, you keep asking us to do new stuff or different stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, really? I'm not really asking you to do anything different. It's like, well,
yeah.
You kind of have to explain.
In corporate computing, it was the same way. We would be dealing with the business side, and they would put in this request, and on a form, writing out, and some groups wouldn't check up on it. You've got to circle back to those people and say, what did you mean by this? And what did you mean by, is this? And you would explain to them what it really means in terms of the system. And then they go, oh, no, that's not what I wanted. So it helps if you spend a lot of time going over the specifications before you even write one line of code, because otherwise you get into a real nightmare. You deliver a product and they go, no, that's not good. I'm not paying you for that.
No, and it's expensive to do too. Getting really good usable specifications takes time,
mm-hmm.
and clients don't necessarily want to pay you for that time.
And it's a big pain in the ass to begin with, because everyone has a different agenda. We want to charge them what our programming time is worth. And back in those days, I think it was like $125 an hour or something like that. And they didn't want to have that come out of their budget, yeah. even though it's not your personal money, it's the company. But everybody has to justify their budgets to somebody up above. And
a company that has people who kind of understand all of this, and they understand that it's going to take more and more money to keep updating their site. Anyway. So I can say that many years ago, I started thinking that I might be able to find some of my old friends online, for instance, from my hometown. And I started searching for information about the high school I'd gone to through my junior year. And I found this website for the high school that had been built by this guy named Scoop Sweeney.
Yeah, what a weenie. Never mind.
And then I figured, I knew this guy, but he was Chip Sweeney.
Yeah.
Now he's Scoop Sweeney.
Hey, I've had more aliases than a mafia hitman, thanks to radio. But, yeah, and I'd been trying to get a line on how to get hold of you, because I saw your name mentioned in some of the online stuff involving Wired and stuff online. And it said you were from Texas. I knew this guy. But I never could find your email address until.
Yeah, I wrote a little bit for Wired. And then they had a system called Hotwired, which was just their web system that they ran. And they put content on there that didn't appear in the magazine. But they also had these chats, they referred to them as various kinds of forums. Like there was one called the Electronic Frontiers Forum, which I ran,
mm-hmm.
and I did that for some time. It'd be like an hour every week. We'd get on, we'd have some guest.
Yeah, I think
and I was that, pretty good at finding guests. So
I think that was what hit me to the fact that you were out there doing that was something in one of the Wired press releases or something that one thing that it may have been, they Wired bought up a daily news feed that I got for a long time. It was just some guys that were on the web all the time, and they would do like this one long page of descriptions of sites.
It sounds like suck.com.
Yeah, I think that was it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was a great site. I got so much great information and great sites out of that. And I think they mentioned you on there. And it's like, I know that guy. And I did.
Yeah, I mean, I did know those guys.
But it took Facebook for us to really hook up, because I encountered you on Facebook. Hey, Imagine.
And here we are.
And there we go. Later. We're about out of our hour.
I think we have about hit the end of the road, and there's probably, I've thought of more things that we could talk about in the future. So,
well, we own the service, so.
Right on. We can do whatever we want to.
I think you're allowed or out loud.
Well, for those of you out there who are listening to this, tell us if there's anything you're interested in hearing from us. It would be cool to hear from our listeners. You can email us at info@plutopia.io. And, you know, I've been thinking lately about what is our focus? What are we really about at Plutopia News Network? So we might be thinking about that some.
Yep. Well, you'll come on by our site, plutopia.io, and you'll find us on Facebook. You'll find us on Twitter. You'll find us sitting on the street corner with a tin cup in our hand.
And if you're seeing this on YouTube, I wish I could figure out how they do that thing where they pop up this thing that says, you should click the subscribe button, you know, and make sure you get notifications every time we publish something.
Well, it seems to work because we do have a lot of subscribers to our YouTube channel where this will end up once it's been put together as a podcast and a YouTube post of the podcast. So you can look for us all over the place.
And we're pretty much ad-free.
Yep, we're non-profit, not by design, but by circumstance.
You're welcome to become patrons through Patreon. That's also on our website, plutopia.io.
Well, John, this has been a lot of fun. I love, you know, babbling on about tech and stuff. And usually a lot of people go, oh, no, God, not more oldies from the tech days. It's like, but there's some among us that really enjoy talking about that. And this was one of those things that we do every now and then just to, you know, fill in on a nice podcast. It was fun, John.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun.
And I guess we will see you around the office cooler. Well, we don't have one, do we? We don't have a water cooler. We don't have any water.
We could always get one.
We'll see you around the bar, though.
Okay.
Bar is always open.
Okay, I'll see you, Scoop.
Thank you, John. You can follow the Plutopia News Network at plutopia.io. On Facebook, go to @PlutopiaNews. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. With John Lepkoski, I'm Scoop Sweeney. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.